Thanks.
Elizabeth, pleased with your ovation as well. To introduce Elizabeth Huddle, who is the new artistic director of Inchimon Theater, already had a very successful season in her first, and is looking forward to a new season in a new place. In fact, the Playhouse, which has been completely revamped, I gather. Is it about all done?
About
two-thirds,
yeah.
At the Seattle Center, and will, so I say, embark on her second season. I knew Elizabeth when she was an actress only, very early days, which I won't even say how long ago. In Oregon Shakespeare Festival, she came as a leading actress almost immediately. She was had such incredible vitality. She played the nurse for me in Romeo and Juliet. She played Viola in a production that I still love, of Twelfth Night. She played, the most recent was Cleopatra, I guess, and Anthony Cleopatra at Ashland. I've never actually had the chance to work with her as an actress. I'm sorry that I didn't miss that, because she's a wonderful person to work with. She's intelligent, clear, great emotional strength as an actress. But she's now temporarily left that and moved into directing. I hope you didn't leave acting forever. She's, in addition to being a successful director at ACT in San Francisco, she was with that, was a company of what was called the Actors Workshop earlier in San Francisco, then was in New York in Lincoln Center for two seasons, has had a long career, a successful career as an actress and director, and I'm so delighted that she's now amongst us here in Seattle. So she's going to talk about some of the perils and pleasures of being an artistic director for the first time. Miss Huddle.
I guess before I get into the perils and pleasures of being an artistic director, I was going to talk a little bit about the transition, because it was an interesting one and it took me very much by surprise that I moved from acting into directing and then from directing into artistic directing, because there's a great deal of administrative work involved in being an artistic director. Hello again, I just keep seeing people I know waving at them. So that transition was not one that I thought out ahead of time at any point. Just as things happened, I sort of went along with them and in retrospect looked back and said, ooh, that was interesting. I wonder why and how that came about. Some of it I can see now. But I began acting really when I was a little kid, very, very young, in my hometown. Fell in love with it at that point. And as I was going from high school into college, I had a high school instructor who said, you know, you really should think about going on into professional theater as a career. Well, and Betty and I were talking at lunch. He said, well, where did you train? Well, back in the old days, there weren't that many places. And if you were from a smallish town on the West Coast, you didn't have any idea where to go to train. The college didn't have, I mean, it's now a university in Sacramento, but at that point it was a teacher's college, and there was no idea of professional training there. And there wasn't any place that I could think of to go other than London, and I didn't know how one did that. I mean, there was no one around to say, you know, you write to RADA and you apply for a scholarship. That's how you go there. But there were no mentor. There was no one to sort of egg me on into that. So I wound up majoring in theater at the local college in Sacramento, and eventually wound up at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is where I finally began getting a real professional grounding, and from there went on professionally into theater without ever having any formal training in theater, other than the fact that I had danced for 10 years and I'd studied music for 10 years and I had been singing for 5 years at that point, studying voice quite seriously. So on my own I was doing that. looked back to realize that as a small child, the man who ran the Civic Theater in Sacramento spent every Saturday of the winter teaching me stage speech and projection as a little kid, and then taking me out as a ham for a hamburger as a reward because I'd done well before we rehearsed for the play all afternoon. And I thought that was the best way you could spend a Saturday in the world. So I was learning how to project, I was learning stage speech, articulation, and discipline. And I didn't even know that because I was like 10 years old, and I was working from 10 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, 5 to 5, nonstop, and thinking it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it was. It was fabulous. And I didn't know I was being trained, so it was sort of happening by osmosis. And then when I got to the Shakespeare Festival, I realized that all of the singing training, all of that stage work, all of that dance work, all of that musical training, that the next thing I needed was script work on Shakespeare, and went at that like a duck to water. And worked there for 4 summers playing, oh God, just lots and lots of roles, some 16 roles. And by that point had played almost, by the time I left there, and then I went back subsequently to work with Bob, et cetera, most of the major roles in Shakespeare. And I finally reached a point where I thought if I didn't, I was forgetting if I had legs or not, because I was always in long skirts, and I wanted to do some contemporary theater. Wound up being apprenticed with a group. Again, I stumble into things. It's the oddest thing. My life has always been a combination of hard work and great good luck, and I wish that on all of you, both things, hard work and great good luck. Wandered into the, or auditioned for, and was accepted into the Actors Workshop a year away from the time when they were selected and taken to New York to open the Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center. I didn't know that was going to happen when I joined the company, but I guess it was actually 2 years later, a year and a half later, in the middle of a production, they closed the theater down, just put us on hold for about 3 or 4 weeks, they paid us, and then boom, I was in New York. There we trained for 3 months together to come together as a company, combining the people from San Francisco with the people who were there from New York, including Faye Dunaway, who did not take to being put into a class at what she felt was the beginning of her major career. And I left rather rapidly. And we then opened the Vivian Beaumont Theater in New York, and I remained with that company for 3 years. I personally don't care for New York. There are a lot of people who thrive on it and who love the theater scene there, who love the city, who love the whole lifestyle. I'm very much a West Coast person. I mean, not that I'm laid back, because as you'll probably notice today, I talk very fast. I am high energy. But I do love the beauty and the space of the West Coast. And I became literally claustrophobic trying to live in New York. Now, there are other people, I won't discourage anybody from trying it or living there and loving it, who adore it. So that was idiosyncratic to me. I simply couldn't function well there. I didn't do my best acting. It got in the way of my whole creative process. I returned there 2 years ago to do a show on Broadway with a friend of mine who talked me into coming back. I was getting ready to leave acting at that point. He said, hell, you got to do one more show. Do another show in New York before you head off into directing. So I went back to do it with him, and I felt the same way. I thought, why do I have to pay $1,500 to live in a closet, to fight my way with a knife in one hand to work at night, when I can live in a beautiful area where I can walk in at least semi-safety to work, and I see a couple of trees now and again. So I didn't take to it any more in my latter life than I did in my early life. So I returned to the West Coast and worked with the Shakespeare Festival in San Diego for a couple of years. And then the really formative period was, and I wish this on all of you, I hope you all have a period in your life where you are in residence with one theater company that will nurture you and allow you to grow as an actor, and perhaps into other areas as a director, maybe as a writer, whatever. Because it was a wonderful experience, because I was there for 10 years with the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. I was given major roles right away, but I also was yanked back after a couple of years by a man named Alan Fletcher, who said, "You are becoming a performer, not an actor." And I didn't know what that meant, really, but he explained it to me. He said, "You've got a lot of glitz and a lot of presence, and you can knock anybody off stage that you want to knock off stage, but I don't believe you some of the time, really believe you, and I don't believe you're really communicating with other actors." He said, "You're cheating." And they pulled me out of all those roles that I just adored playing. And they put me into very simple, naturalistic plays, usually with Alan directing, and took me back to the beginning and carefully made me think through what I was doing. I had never, and at the same time, he started me teaching. And so the whole process of developing actors that they were doing at ACT, I began working with him teaching me to teach, and at the same time influencing me as an actor. And after some 2 or 3 years of that, he said, "Now it's time for you to start directing." Well, by that time, I was really hooked. My acting had changed profoundly. I could tell the difference. I was pleased with the work that I was doing then as an actor, and then went through a period where I really did what I wanted to do with my life as an actor, and I finished with it. I did Turgenev's Month in the Country, all in one season, Turgenev's Month in the Country, the lead in The Visit, a Feydeau farce, and the lead in the Shaw about the apocalypse, the end of the world, or the Heartbreak House. And that was all in one season, and at the end of that season, I went off and played a major role in a film, in an independent film, a huge role I spent 3 months doing. By the time I'd finished all of that, I could tell that I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish, and that the next creative role for me was to direct. And Alan had really led me to that, and I loved it. I loved the process. I understood the process. I understood what actors have to go through, and I loved being able to have the understanding of what needed to be accomplished and to guide to that, and at the same time get out of an actor's way when you need to get out of their way, to leave them the space and at the same time to guide. So for the next couple of years, I didn't trust that was really happening. I did some directing and some acting and some directing and some acting. And finally decided, well, I'll just get out of rep for a while, I'll get out of theater for a while and reevaluate. This was such a funny way to discover. So I went to LA and became a TV actor. And I said, "That's it. I really don't like acting anymore, personally." Did some of, the more wonderful things in my life. And I must confess, I mean, I talk blithely on about having now being a director more than, and I am a director. I still cheat, though. I'm still on Hill Street once in a while, and I have to go down next week, and I'm filming a couple of more Hill Streets. So I still go back and pick up a nice little paycheck and go down and play with those guys once in a while. But it wasn't what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I knew there was something else that needed to be committed to. And even more than directing, it became apparent that I wanted some kind of total involvement in an ongoing creative effort in which I had major control. I was ready for that. I wanted that. I wanted to influence the direction of something. And so when the opportunity came up with Intiman, my new husband, I was just recently remarried, or at least I was at that point before I came here, who is from Seattle, had me consider this job at Intiman. And I took it, not really knowing if I could do it or not. But figuring I could figure it out as I went along somehow. And I said, "Just pretend you're an artistic director. No one will know the difference, Liz." So that's sort of what I did. I mean, with great authority, I would walk into meetings not having the foggiest notion what was supposed to come out of the meeting, but I would figure it out as I went along. And I knew how to direct a play, so I loved that process last summer, directing the plays. I understood auditioning people. I understood all of that. The administrative running of the company I've had to learn, and I've enjoyed learning that. It's been fun. And I guess part of what is any transition that you feel coming up in your life, if it really feels right, don't worry too much that you don't totally
know how to bring it about, as long as you know you've got the foundation that's there, the knowledge that's going to be necessary that you can figure out how to add up into it. In other words, if suddenly somewhere along the line you say, maybe I would be interested in directing, or maybe I could write for the theater as well as act, give it a go. Because you've got the, in your training as actors, you've got the foundations for the other aspects of theater. And even if you're not sure about the process, you can learn that as you go along. So don't deny yourself the opportunity to move out into other areas. So now, after a year of this new job, I'll tell you what it's all about. You've got it figured out. Not really, but I'm still learning. But I do enjoy it immensely. The one of the things that I have discovered is that in being the artistic director of a theater company, as well as probably being, let's say, the CEO, the chief executive officer of a corporation, you're not expected to be the management advisor. I really felt as though that's where I was not qualified. I said, God, I don't know how to manage a company. How in God's name? You don't have to. What they're really looking for, that's the managing director's job. What they're really looking for from an artistic director, the same as they are for a director of a production, although you also have to be a manager in that regard, is a vision of leadership that is clear, coherent, and that more or less is able to build on itself with some degree of consistency, which is still allows artistic changeability, because God knows I've changed my mind about this and that as we go along. But still in all, I've had to develop what Intimon means for people. And the staff has drug that out of me as we've gone along, because it's a theater that does the classics. We're called the classic theater. And they said, well, what does that mean, Liz? It means we do the classics. And they said, well, what does that mean to you? We need to know what it means to you. Never mind how to run the theater and all that. We can figure that out. Tell us what we are. Be for us what we are. And in that process, have developed a philosophy that encompasses doing the classics as well as doing contemporary theater. Because there we will do, I'm almost sure, always one contemporary play, with at least one contemporary play within our season. For starters, I stopped calling it Seattle's Classic Theater. It's going off of our logo as soon as I can get it off. That is part and parcel of what we do, but that's not what we're going to be called any longer. The mission is to do the classics as well as contemporary theater. Without big physical productions, in an intimate surround, and with the play, any given production, being centered on the actor, rather than on a directorial image of what this play can be. We'll probably not do Hamlet in the nude. We'll probably not do Chekhov in whiteface, which doesn't mean we can't do something innovative with it, but it is not an egoistic reflection of the play through a director's eye that I'm interested in for this theater. I'm interested in finding the meaning of those plays in the period they were written. If necessary, translate that into another period, but always illuminating the basic meaning of the play. I look for actors who are capable of doing that, who are able to handle language, who are able to move, who are able to understand the ideology of these plays. And that's what we do. The reason I do the classics is because that's what the theater is. But my reason for loving, my reason for being attracted to this theater, my reason for wanting to do it, is that there is a tremendous spiritual nourishment in plays that have outlived little sociological happenings of their period. So that something that was written 500 years ago can still have a tremendous impact, and in fact even a larger impact, because it addresses our humanity, why we're alive, how we relate to each other. I'm also interested in plays that, whenever they were written, address human rights and the ethics of social responsibility. Little Foxes I'm doing this year has to do with a group of people destroying the South quite avariciously after the Civil War. Doll's House, it deals with, it was the first play written about women's rights. That's all important to me. I'm doing Seahorse with colorblind casting. That's important to me. It will be a mixed racial couple playing in Seahorse. Not written for that. Doesn't need to be. It can be anybody. So Tamu Gray will be playing the woman, and she will be just wonderful in it. So it has to do with finding plays that are great both in form and in content, and that can reverberate through a contemporary society and still really mean something to us. And then finding a group of actors that can pull those plays off and centering the plays around those actors. And it's not easy. You really need tremendous training to be able to handle the language of these plays. You really have to have it, either in class or in experience. You have to. And you can't fake it. I can tell in 3 minutes if somebody can handle language or not. You can. Anybody can. I mean, it's the old joke, you know, to be or not to be. Next. Then after that, after the technical ability to handle the language and to be able to use and use your body is a reality, an idiosyncratic ability to bring those characters alive. I also totally loathe to be or not to be, that is, the, you know, I mean, blah, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. So that you know what it means, and you can handle the language, and you can personalize it and make it your own, and you can relate to another actor on stage while speaking in iambic pentameter and make me believe that you're really relating to that other person. Those are unique and wonderful, and wonderful, wonderful actors. There are a lot of them in Seattle, and I collect those people around me. So that's the ideology behind Entomon. That's one of the things an artistic director has to think about and do. In terms of just running the company, you begin a year by choosing plays. You have a lot of practical restrictions. I can't hire more than a play that has more than 12 actors in it. I can't afford to do it. By the end of the season, or by one end of the season, I have to have a play with 4 actors in it. So I have to construct a season that goes from 4 to 12 or from 12 to 4. I have to construct a season that has variety in terms of drama and comedy, and it moves around in some different periods. At the same time, keeping this, how many actors I can have in between. I try to have a company as much as possible. I had more of a company last year than I have this year. The company this year tends to move with the plays. They'll be cast in the first 2, and then 2 and 3, and then 3 and 4, and then 4 and 5. So the people are in 2 or 3 productions this year rather than stretching through all 5. You have to choose the other directors. And again, I've decided that one of those directors should be someone from Seattle. The actors are 95% from Seattle. And that one of the other guests, I have to direct 3 of the 5. That's part of my contract. Some artistic directors direct, some just produce. But I direct and produce. And I now have Richard Allen Edwards is a local director. Warner Shook is not. He directed here last year. Began as a student of mine at ACT. Oh God, I guess it was 15 years ago. And is now directing for me. He began as an actor, also went into directing. So you choose the directors, the plays, you hold auditions. And the auditioning process is interesting because you're both looking for very specific people for specific roles, and you're also filing away people for future reference. And I tell people, and they don't believe me, I can file somebody away for a long time. I don't forget them, and I just keep waiting for when it's right to use them. I keep a small acting file. I only keep the people that I'm really interested in, and I go over it all the time to make sure I really am considering those people that I want to consider. And when I audition, I really do look at people carefully, and will bring someone back if I'm not sure of their work. After all of that, after the kind of open auditioning, and you've got the plays chosen, then you'll do callback readings for more specifics, and at that point bring in actors that you know quite well to see if they're right for individual roles. And you start putting a company together. Simultaneously, you start talking with designers. Now, it depends on how the theater runs. We have a wonderful production manager at Entomont, and he does a lot of the kind of initial getting in touch with designers. He'll talk with them and say, are you available, are you not available? And then get them in touch with me, and we'll talk. And interestingly enough now, this year, the gentleman is going to design the unit set, and one of the costumers are from here to you, it's Sarah. We'll be doing Doll's House together, and Bill Forrester is doing unit set for the whole season, and working on three of the productions, two of them with me, doing the individual design for that individual production, the set decor. So then you put together all your designers. Then you begin having design conferences, getting all of that set for the season, and before you know it, you're into rehearsal. Simultaneously with that, you're out raising money. You're wandering around to various clubs, corporations, or whatever, trying to get the money ready for whatever you need it for, and thinking about the next season. I'm already into 1988. I've got a fairly good idea of what I want to do in 1988, and I've got two grants out on two productions that I want to do already. I have to, and I'm head on a bunch of stuff I want to do for 1989. So I'm up there. I mean, I'm that far ahead, and you really have to be that far ahead. I work with an administrative staff, and that I suppose is the most difficult for me. Somewhere around when I'm not actually in production. Somewhere around 3 o'clock, after I've been in an office all day, I start going buggy. I'm just not used to doing it. And I kind of get up and do, scream and yell and run around the office. But I'm getting better at it. I'm getting more used to that. Because you also have to guide the development people. You have to work with the managing director and guide in development, marketing and PR, and general office running of the theater, and you really have to be a part of that. I know someone who once divorced themselves from all of that and wound up not running the theater anymore, just totally lost track of it. You really have to stay in touch with all that. Once you get into the season, you're directing a lot of plays and still trying to keep the rest of it somehow in balance. You no more finish the season, then bingo, you're practically right on into the next one, it feels like. That's the funny thing. It isn't like when you guys go off now and do a season somewhere, you'll finish it and there'll be this sense of relief, and then you're scrambling to find the next job, but there's a time off, or when you finish, like it's here, when you finish a semester or whatever. It doesn't finish. The instant the last production is closed, you're right into the planning for the next season, almost immediately. So I find it exciting, challenging, frustrating, and invigorating, I guess, all of those things together. There are a lot of actors moving out into other areas of the theater now. It was interesting. Somebody asked me an interview the other day, and I get this a lot. Did you find as a woman that it was difficult to be accepted as a director and then as an artistic director? And I said, no, I found it difficult as an actor to be accepted as a director and then as an artistic director. I had to build my credibility as a director. That's all I'm known as here in Seattle. But when I lived other places, it was like, yeah, she's going to direct a play. What do you think? You know, directors are spring full grown from their mother's womb. I mean, they develop too, you know. So that was the interesting progress, was moving from actor to director. My sexuality didn't seem to have, or my sex, didn't seem to have anything to, didn't seem to influence it very much one way or the other, or I didn't perceive that as being a problem, so maybe that's why it wasn't a problem. I've rambled on and on and on, and I'd like you now to ask me some questions, if you would please, things that interest you specifically. It doesn't have to be about anything I talked about. Yeah?
Do you believe not-for-profit theaters should use market research to formulate proceeds?
Do I believe that not-for-profit theaters should use market research to formulate their season? I would say that on a non-regimented basis, in terms of common sense, using the same principles from market research, yes.
My, i.e., my most popular production last year was Mrs. Warren's Profession. I'm opening with Man and Superman this year. I had to use some of those principles to come to that, right? It also is a very great and wonderful play. But to simply categorize choices that way, to me, would take all of the spontaneity and the idiosyncratic choice out of something. Seahorse isn't going to sell a ticket, probably. I don't care. I have my own artistic reasons for doing that play. But I also use my noggin and put in four others that I know the people that expect a classic are going to damn well get a classic when they walk in there, you know? So I do and I don't, but I utilize the principles involved, but I wouldn't strictly use that in terms of choosing a season, no, because otherwise we could just computer program the whole thing and we wouldn't need human beings. Yeah, hi. Who's in the company this year? Don't you dare all rush to the office and ask for audition for me, you're all too young. I just lost my leading lady for the first show. She called me up and said in a trembling voice, I'm pregnant. And I said, oh, congratulations. Then I called her husband up. In the company are, from last year, Glenn Mazin, Michael Santo, John Aylward, Suzanne Bouchard, Clayton Corzott. From previous companies are Megan Cole, Mark Jenkins. New this year are from the Bath, well, there's only one left from the Bath House because Gretchen's not going to be in the company, Mark Anders. A new actor from The Empty Space who's in the entire season, Kurt Beatty, who's a superb actor. And Tamu Gray is coming from the Milwaukee Rep. Byron Jennings is coming in from the Denver Theater Center. Those are the only. Tamu is actually a Seattle actress who is now working in Milwaukee. Byron is the only one who's totally from the outside. And Barbara. Did I say that funny? Barbara Dirickson.
It's a one-way lock.
Oh, right. But Barbara Dirickson is coming in for one production. She's an actress who is just now going into rehearsal for Moon for the Misbegotten at the Rep. She's a superb actress who's brand new to Seattle. She just moved here with her husband. She luckily already had her baby, so she's carrying around a 3-month baby as she rehearses. And I think that's sort of it. I don't know if I've forgotten. Maybe not. Yes?
When do actors and also designers stop being too young?
Oh no, I meant for this particular role, that's all. I need somebody. See, Kurt is in his mid, and I'm not quite sure where how old he is, but he's in his mid to late 30s, so to be trying to work together now this year. But Jerry Hooker, who I worked with last year, was a young designer here in town that I discovered. I saw a production that he did in CAG and talked with him, and we got along beautifully, and I said, oh, I'll take a chance on you. And he said, oh my God, because he did the unit set last year for all 5 shows. And I said, you know, you may get yourself creamed. Everyone may scream, this is a dreadful idea. He said, well, if you've got the courage to hire me, I've got the courage to try. Mm-hmm. So we did it. And he was young. I mean, older than you are, but still. It depends. I mean, it's good to start early anyway to sort of see where you are. I mean, if you think you're ready to talk with Peter Allen, then once he gets the theater open, right now he's swamped trying to get the new theater on. You make an appointment, you bring your portfolio in and you sit and you talk with him, and then he'll come and say, I think this person's going to be ready soon to do something. I really think you should take a look at it, or here's somebody to, you know, I want to look at at the end of the year and you should look at it. That's the process. Going about it. Yes?
When you were talking about the ideology of your theater, you talked about finding the basic meaning of a
play.
Yes.
Rather than having a director come up with a concept. Now, do you think that a play has a single basic meaning and it's up to the director to find it? Or does the director bring an individual point of view to that process that will shape the formation of the idea?
Well, I think that's a two-way street. I think they're both true. I do think that a play generally is written for a specific reason. It does have within its narrative, usually you can find the primary purpose of that play within the context of the society in which it was written. Then, if you're going to move it out of that, you need to have a very clear idea of why will it illuminate really what this play meant in terms of its society, i.e., when I did Good Person of Szechuan, I've done that many times. I played Shantae a lot. And every time I did it, and we were all out there in our little Chinese dresses, it didn't work. You know, and I said, why doesn't this work? It's because the play is about, really, poverty. And it's about a society that denies poverty, or denies that it needs to do something to take care of poverty. So I did reset it in a camp in the 30s, a worker camp in the 30s in America, and then the play worked. So that was a case where moving it went to the central meaning of the play, and then it worked. And he was a man who was developing a Marxist ideology out of the Second World War, and had transplanted it into a fairy tale place because he liked that in the theater, and it obscured the play every time we tried to do it. It got lost in the fairy tale and the really hideous poverty of the piece. Well, of course, the audience sat there and went, oh my God, but they got the point, of it. So that it's a back and forth street. What you hear, that kind of edge that you hear coming into my voice when I talk about a director imposing on play, I've seen quite a bit of theater, both back east and in Europe over the past 3, 4, 5 years, and there are times when I cannot tell why the play has been taken out of context and redone. And when I saw literally a cherry orchard in white face with a nude scene that I couldn't, it made no sense to me at all. I mean, that play is about the death of one society and the rebirth of another one. And nothing that was done in that production illuminated that at all. Now, you could reset it and you could put it in the South after the Civil War. You could, what are some of the other things to do with cherry orchard? To rediscover that core. I mean, you could do a lot of things with it. But to throw in just nude scenes and white face, all that said was, I'm in the mainstream of what's happening in Europe. Because everything I saw was in white face. Everything. So, do you see my... Okay, that's really what I mean. If there's a point to it and the director can find his vision and still find the basic meaning of play, great. But a lot of the time, I can't find the play. And then I become hideously irritated. I also don't like puppet theater. I don't like actors being used as puppets unless it is a visual, visionary piece that is meant to be that from the get-go. But I've worked with André Serban. I think the man is probably a genius, but I swear to God, trying to act under him and under another man from the Berliner Ensemble. I learned about Brecht from a man from the Berliner Ensemble. God bless him, I'm glad I got to play Grusha under him, but I almost died. I mean, you take one step, no, take two steps. No, the right foot turns out this way, that's good, okay, now sing the song. No, don't sing that way, sing it this way. I mean, everything is dictated, lined up. André Serban was the same way. I remember asking, I went up to him, but there were 35 people waiting to come on behind me. We were in tech rehearsal. And I said, André, could you give me a hint if we're going to come on stage left or stage right? I don't think about that until it happens. I said, never mind. You just call us when you're, we'll be ready. And then we entered in the final scene of the, what's that wonderful, the shark has, this is a game we play with me, I can't remember names. Three Penny Opera, with bananas to watch him hang himself. I said, why are we eating bananas?
I like that image.
But I mean, I'm going to tell some funny stories now, but they really, they're funny, but they really, they get at me. If you walked into the theater, looked at the theater and said, okay, take out all of the seats, we play out here, and we play out here, put all of the audience up on the stage. This was in a 1,400 seat theater. And he was going to put us out, and they said, this theater was built in 1901, we can't do that, you know, it's not able to be adapted. And and then my other favorite story was, I was playing Ginny in it, and I was dying to sing, what's her famous song? It's not Mac the Knife, what's it? Oh, Pirate Jenny song. Dying to sing it. Well, if you've ever seen the score, it was written Polly. I didn't know that. And of course, because of the casting, Jenny got to sing it originally, and Jenny usually does it a lot of the time, but he'd never, first they played the score for him, and we sat there, poor Andre, if we ever worked together again, I didn't know. Anyway, we sat and he listened to the score, and he usually works with Liz Swaddles or somebody, and he sat and he listened to Kurt Vile's magnificent music and said, no, we don't use that music, we'll use something else. And we said, no, you have to use that. So then we got into rehearsal, and Polly was going to sing the Pirate Jenny song. Well, it took, threatening to kill myself and quit till I finally got it. So I got the song, only to discover that I was behind the whole thing was done in cardboard boxes, which he had designed for the rehearsal room, because he doesn't see, you can't think about where he's going to go, only in the space where I am can I work. Well, so the set was designed for the rehearsal room. Couldn't see anybody. There were these giant cardboard boxes. Trying to find, it was a cast of 20. Couldn't see anybody. So I was behind a cardboard box with a mask on. Trying to sing the Pirate Jenny song. And the costume designer came over and said, don't worry, I've got sequins. You can't, there's a sequin every place on your body, there's a sequin. So what you could then get was sort of glints of sequins coming out from behind this box as I would sort of peek around it, because he thought that was interesting to have me just kind of not seen, only heard. I said, no, not this song. Finally, I went to the assistant director and I said, good God, can't you do something? He said, I will, if you will promise me not to say a word back, on your honor, now. And I said, you'll get me out of the mask, out from behind the box, so I can sing the song. Yes, I said, okay. I promise, no matter what he said. He came to me about later that afternoon, he said, oh, Liz, I'm so sorry, I didn't know your problem. I said, what problem? He said, it's okay. We'll take off the mask. We'll put you in front of the box. I mean, I didn't know you had that much trouble getting focus on stage. Oh, well, it's just something I learned to live with. I'll do my best with the song. I'll struggle through with it down center, So I finally did it, but it was through. Anyway, it was that, it's that kind of, and I tell funny stories about it. That's what I try to avoid happening, so that an actor is, is that it? We're there, we finished. Okay. I really enjoyed talking about it.
Thank you. All Dan Paul Mitchell has the cover story of the rock.
I didn't even register with the
boy, I got number 39.
I better work on this.